Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889, and by French Market Coffee, locally roasted in New Orleans for 125 years. From WWNO New Orleans and our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. On this week's Louisiana Eats, we're asking the eternal question, coffee, tea, or, well, you can make that decision by the end of the show, because this week, we're doing a deep dive on both industries to learn everything from where the leaves and beans originate to the role that Louisiana plays in the industry. We'll visit the Mammoth Louisiana Tea Facility in New Orleans East, where third-generation tea master Malcolm Shalders works side-by-side with his son Scott, ensuring the consistency and quality of both their hot and iced teas. Then, we travel to Shreveport, where we experience the ultimate tea ceremony, utilizing some of the rarest teas on earth with tea fanatic Garrett Johnson. But don't worry, next it's coffee time, as we visit French Truck Coffee founder Jeffrey Meeker for a coffee cupping experience that will open your mind and your taste buds. The kettle's on and the water's boiling on this week's Louisiana Eats. While riding around New Orleans, you may have seen a tiny antique yellow truck and done a double take. These unusual European antique vehicles belong to French Truck Coffee, a small batch purveyor of fine coffee that's become wildly popular over the past few years. Owner Jeffrey Meeker and his team are at the vanguard of what many are calling the third wave coffee movement in America, a culture that comes with its own vocabulary, from cortado to OG. We visited Jeffrey for a tour and cupping. That's coffee's equivalent to a wine tasting. To begin, I asked Jeffrey how he went from a career in fine dining to roasting coffee.
So I came to New Orleans back in 1999 to help open the W Hotel that is no longer on Poydras, and worked all over the country in fine dining restaurants. Then we moved away right after the storm, and while we were away, my cousin brought me a bag of freshly roasted coffee, and I tasted it, and it was better than any coffee I'd ever had in my life. And I had been working in fine dining restaurants all my life, and I had no idea why coffee could taste this much better than it had ever tasted in all these nice restaurants that I worked in. It was from a company in San Francisco that you might know of, Blue Bottle. So I started doing the research, and I figured out that the guy who started Blue Bottle was a clarinetist in the San Francisco Philharmonic, had no cooking experience.
Very qualified.
I figured if he could do it, I could do it. And so I started putting it all together, and I fell in love with these little French trucks.
Where'd you find these little French trucks?
Well, this one is actually was built in Belgium and was with a collector in New York. We also have one that is actually the oldest example in the United States. It's a 1955. And it was in Quebec. And then our original one, which is the little yellow one that's the same color as Veuve Clicquot label, which is where I got the color, is from Bordeaux and was a plumber's truck. But there's not a whole lot of them left. There's only about 100 examples in the United States. They're two-cylinder engines, so little tiny engine, and they get 50 miles per gallon, and they're perfect for New Orleans.
So, Jeffrey, the business really started in the little trucks. What
Kinda.
Happened?
The trucks were my delivery vehicle, and obviously my marketing as well. But I started out in my laundry room with a little tiny roaster, and I went around to all the people I knew in the food business and said, hey, I'm back in New Orleans. And, oh, what are you doing? What restaurant are you working at? And I explained it, and they said, oh, well, let me try some. And then we just started building more and more and more and started doing more and more wholesale. I think we've got 30 restaurants in the area that use our coffee. We started out in the warehouse right behind the building we're at now, with no windows, barely any air conditioning. Then we moved to this space and opened the little shop in the front. And then most recently, we opened the place on Dryades.
Would you talk to us briefly about what is being called today third wave coffee? Would you walk us through that?
Sure. So first wave coffee would be considered Folgers, Maxwell House, the stuff our parents bought when we were growing up. And used to be that you would go to the small local store and they'd have a coffee roaster in the corner and a bag of coffee and they'd just roast some every week and everybody'd go buy it. Well, then World War I, II, the mechanization of pretty much all of our foodstuffs happened. And then you got these huge roasters like Folgers and Maxwell House, and it became less regional. Then you had second wave, and second wave really happened in the 60s and 70s, and that was Starbucks, Peet's. A lot of those national brands started really changing things. And, you know, a lot of people have some disdain for what Starbucks does, but if it weren't for Starbucks, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing, because people wouldn't pay good money for coffee. They would just think Folgers pricing. You know, you can still buy a can of Folgers for under $10, and that's a big can. So when I tell somebody I've got a bag of coffee that's $14 or $15, they don't blink because of Starbucks. Third wave, and you know, technically I guess we fall under it, is what we do, which is more of a connoisseur's approach to coffee, more of a craft, and very much pulling from the culinary world and the wine world on how you do things to maximize the experience of the coffee.
And what about the mystique of the pour over?
Well, it's not complicated, number one. Number two, it is a uniquely American way to prepare coffee. But, you know, if you have the right equipment, the right temperature of water, and the right ratio of water to coffee, it's, to my estimation, the very best cup of coffee you can have because of the craft of it. And we actually just installed a robot at our Dryad Street that makes pour-overs, and so they are perfectly the same every time.
Oh my goodness. From a little teeny antique truck from France to a robot. Now,
yes.
You've really hit the full spectrum here.
Yes.
So what are we going to see next?
Let's go inside. We'll show you some of the equipment, and then we'll taste some of the fruits of that labor.
So now we're where all the action happens.
Right. This is all of our manufacturing currently. And you can see with these huge piles of coffee, that's about a week and a half's worth of coffee that we'll roast. When it comes in from the farmers, having been stripped down to what we can roast. Mm-hmm. And you can smell that. It almost smells like green peas a little bit.
Yeah, it does.
And this is how it comes in from all over the world. So in front of you, you've got Colombia. There's some Sumatra, Peru.
How do you source your coffee?
Our coffee, we work with a broker, and the broker helps put relationships together with farmers. We sample roast the coffee, so we get these little tiny samples, and we roast those up, and we taste them, and we do a cupping like we're gonna do here in a few minutes to ascertain the quality, what roast level we should roast it to make sure that it's maximizing its flavor potential. It's very much like food or wine. With wine, you've gotta make sure that it's got just the right amount of oak and just the right amount of age. Same thing with coffee. We have to just the right amount of roast. And that's important for us to figure out so that we can give our customers that information so that they can have as great an experience at home as we can provide in the cafes.
Jeffrey, is it unusual for a relatively small coffee operation to have a relationship directly with the farmers?
It's changing, and similar to the wine industry where all the farmers used to dump all their wine together and there was just Bordeaux wine. The coffee farmers have figured out that some of them do a better job than others, and so they ought to get paid more. And with the advent of technology, iPhones, et cetera, it's much easier to get those connections made. You don't have to get on a donkey and go down a trail to go talk to the farmer. You can get him on his iPhone and ask him how his crop's doing that year, and does he want to buy, can you buy from him again that year?
Explain the economics of this.
Well, the farmer does all of the work. Really, we are 10% of the equation. And so that farmer then goes to his local co-op and says, I want to sell coffee. And if that local co-op is hooked up with someone like us, they can see how much potential that coffee has and then get it into our hands to say, your coffee's really good. You've been doing a really good job at a farmer. These guys will pay more because of the quality of your coffee.
Have you met any of your farmers?
We have. And one of it nearly moved me to tears was meeting one of our farmers and him standing with his family in front of a house with a bag of our coffee in his arms as a trophy or a prize, explaining to us that the money that we had given him for his coffee helped him build the new house for his family.
How exciting. Yeah. It must be so rewarding to not only be giving people truly delicious coffee, but to know you're making a difference in another part of the world.
Yeah, and it makes everything make sense. And it gives us more reverence for what we're doing.
Well, where would you like us to go now?
Let's look at some of the roasting equipment and explain how it works, and then we'll taste some coffee. So this is our big baby. This is our pride and joy. The coffee starts at the very top in this funnel. So you've got a big cylinder in there with paddles to move the beans around. And when the temperature is exactly right, the roaster has a trap door under here and it'll let all the beans into that chamber. And then as it cooks, it's very much like baking bread. We go through different stages of browning and caramelization so that we create those sugars in the coffee to make it sweet or bitter or citrusy.
Visually, what are you looking for?
Well, visually is not nearly as important as is scent and sound. Coffee goes through something called first crack. And it happens around 385 to 390 degrees. And the coffee, it's almost like popcorn. It gives up and it makes a pop sound. We're gonna hear it here in just a few minutes. It'll start popping. And that is a really good indication to the roaster that it's developed enough of those caramels and those flavors, but it's time to start paying attention to when to get it out of there and cool it off. And the smells, I think when you smelled it before, probably got a little baking bread. We'll start getting more of those coffee smells.
I have to admit, this is the first time I've ever heard about the sound.
Our target temperature is really close. Let's stay here for just a second and watch what happens. So downdraft has just turned on. We heard a beep. That's the computer telling the fan to turn on so that we are ready to cool the coffee off so it doesn't go over temperature. And now the stirring mechanism has turned on and the door opens. So now we're at what we call our cupping table. And if you look at it, it's basically a giant Lazy Susan on skateboard wheels. And what we do at this table is, this is where we're deciding whether or not a coffee is of a quality we want to buy, number one. And then number two, after we have made the commitment to buying it, how do we want to roast it? So what I'd have you do to begin with is, we've got five different coffees on the table, three single origin, and then there are also two blends on the table. So I'm going to run the grinder here. The difference between freshly roasted coffee and coffee that's about, let's say, a month old, it's night and day. So what we start out with is, take it and just kind of knock it against your palm to shake up the molecules and give it a good sniff, and then we'll turn the table. So what we're doing now is we're ascertaining what different aromatics it has. And it may have chocolate, it may have almonds, blueberries, raspberries, mango, black pepper, coffee.
Amazing.
Yeah, coffee is just as complicated as food and wine as far as the aroma compound. So the next step in our cupping, now that our coffee has cooled down and we're taking the grounds off the top, is to slurp the coffee. Did you have a favorite?
I think the one that I liked the best was the very, very darkest one.
Oh yeah?
Yeah.
I'm not surprised. Coffee is like food and wine, it's experiential. And it ties back to memories. Because aroma is our most tightly wound memory. So on the table, we had a Kenyan. This is from Peru, and that's a single origin. This is Le Grand Coq Rouge, which is our breakfast blend, and it's a Colombian-based blend that we serve to a lot of restaurants that would like to have a breakfast blend. This is an Ethiopian, and then this is our New Orleans Premium Dark Roast, which is the darkest of our coffees, and it's a blend of Colombian and Brazilian coffee.
I guess you can't take the hometown girl out of the hometown, even
That's
when
right.
it comes to gourmet coffee.
That's right. So you want to end with your favorite? That
yes.
way you've got it.
That was wonderful.
I'm glad you liked it.
Jeffrey Meeker, owner of French Truck Coffee.
Start to combing out my hair. I drink 40 cups of coffee. 40 cups of coffee. 40 cups of coffee waiting for you to come home.
What is chicory and how is it used in coffee? Stay tuned and we'll answer that question when we come right back. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Rouse's Markets and by Brennan's Restaurant. Reimagined, renovated, and reborn. Start your day the New Orleans way with a decadent breakfast featuring Chef Slade Rushing's updated and elevated classic Creole cuisine. Breakfast, lunch, dinner, and private events at 417 Royal Street in the historic French Quarter. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. What is chicory, and how and why is it used in coffee? First, there's chicory and root chicory, two entirely different species. Chicory is a salad green you're undoubtedly familiar with, radicchio and Belgian endive. Chicory root is used in coffee. It's long been cultivated commercially in Europe, where it's baked, roasted, and ground before being sold as a coffee additive. Although most people think that chicory adds bitterness to coffee, it contains inulin, a polysaccharide similar to starch. So actually, chicory adds a sweetness and a viscosity that make iced coffee and chicory especially good. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats.
You're the cream in my coffee. You're the salt in my stew. You will always be my necessity. I'd be lost without you. You're the starch in my collar. You're the lace in my shoe. You will always be my necessity. I'd be lost without you.
Pagoda Cafe, a diminutive restaurant whose building perfectly fits its name, is situated along Bayou Road in the 7th Ward of New Orleans. In addition to a breakfast and lunch menu, Pagoda features an expansive drinks menu using coffee roasted by French Truck. The Neighborhood Cafe is also one of the only spots in New Orleans where you can order a flat white. What exactly is a flat white, you might ask? Producer Sarah Holtz visited Pagoda on a busy Saturday morning to find out.
My name is Shauna Sassoon, and I am the co-owner and co-manager of Pagoda Cafe. A flat white is my favorite coffee drink. It is a shot of espresso and a small amount of steamed milk tiniest little bit of foam on top. It is basically a short latte. So flat white is an Australian coffee drink. It's common in any cafe in Australia. Half of our DNA here at Pagoda is Australian because my partner, Dan Etheridge, is Australian. And one thing that he's missing here in New Orleans was Australian-style cafes. What he loved about cafes in Australia was that there was substantial food, you could get a good lunch, but there was also kick-ass coffee, and you didn't have to choose between those two things. And an Australian cafe is a little different from an American cafe in that it's more focused on being social and enjoying the food and coffee. So I think for a while in America, coffee shops became synonymous with like working. And we wanted to create the opposite of that. So some people come here and they work, they have meetings or they get on their computer, but we tried to create a space that would really stimulate being social, relaxing, enjoying what you're eating, enjoying what you're drinking. And Australians are also not pretentious and not too fussy, and so they like things simple. You don't find sizes, and so one of the reasons the flat white exists is people wanted a small latte, essentially. And so instead of having different sizes and making things complicated, they're very precise about what's in your coffee drink. So that precision of how much milk you have, how much espresso you have, how much little foam you have, is what defines Australian coffee, but also, you know, making it really simple. So I'm delighted that people are into flat whites and are discovering them. It's just a nice short drink. You don't want to get bogged down with too much milk. You want to stay light for your day, but you want that creamy deliciousness that a latte has. That's what a flat white is for. Ash, what'd you make a flat white? We exclusively use coffee from French Truck Roasters. We've been working with them since we opened and since when they were starting out. We really are committed to super high quality coffee, roasted to order, and we love working with them because they bring us new stuff, they tweak our beans. They also really understood that we weren't going for a bright, fruity, lighter coffee, which has been in vogue for a little while, that we were really going for a darker, richer, chocolatey espresso. I think we try and serve really first-rate, amazing coffee without the pretension. It's work a day. People come in here all day long and are rushing, going off to work, or they're coming for a minute, and we want to demystify it. It's not something that should be inaccessible. It's not something that should take 20 minutes to get your coffee. None of us have handlebar mustaches to twirl. You know, we're simplifying it to a level that people can access it and feel really comfortable with it. Sometimes they come in and they wonder where our inside is if they've never been here before, because we're 300 square feet in all outdoor seating. And so they'll call in and say, can I make reservations? We've heard such good things. And I'm like, baby, just come in, pretend you're like at the beach, get a coffee, sit outside. But some people are a little surprised.
Just around the corner, there's a rainbow in the sky. So let's have another cup of coffee and let's have another piece of pie.
That was Shauna Sassoon of Pagoda Cafe.
So let's have another cup of coffee and let's have another piece of pie. Let a smile be your umbrella, or it's just an April shower.
In many fine restaurants these days, you'll find a chop, a steak, or even a burger with a coffee rub that adds a surprising depth of flavor. It's very easy to experiment with your own coffee rub at home. To mix together a basic batch, combine a half cup finely ground coffee with 3 tablespoons of kosher salt and 1/4 cup of coarsely ground pepper. This mix can be stored in an airtight container for over a month. Once you've got the coffee rub base made, use 2 tablespoons of rub per 1.5 pounds of protein. Now the real experimentation can begin. I like to add some light brown sugar to my rub, adding about one part sugar to two parts of the pre-made coffee rub. Other dried flavoring ingredients can be added in small amounts, like dry mustard, dried ginger, paprika, chili powder, coriander, and oregano. Those are all good choices, but should be used in moderation, adding only about an eighth or a quarter teaspoon for each pound and a half of protein. Once you've gently applied the rub, the meat can sit uncovered in the fridge for up to a day before cooking to absorb the delicious flavors. Then, just roast or pan fry or grill as you normally would the cut of meat. For a copy of this recipe, visit our Louisiana Eats website at itsneworleans.com and wwno.org. I'm Poppy Tooker, and coffee rubs make for good Louisiana Eats. Our friend Chris J. once wrote an article that began, quote, "Garrett Johnson hates sweet tea," unquote. In a traditional southern community like Shreveport, you'd think that would have made for some bad publicity. But Garrett is cultivating a different kind of reputation. As the only tea educator in Louisiana, he's spreading the gospel of fine loose-leaf tea through a series of lectures and local gatherings. Garrett invited us to the table to learn about traditional hot tea and sample some of his favorite brews. How did tea become your big thing?
What actually starts in New Orleans. I'm from Mandeville, Louisiana, so my dad worked at One Shell Square down in New Orleans, and there he met an international community that he really bonded with. And because he, you know, was an adventuresome eater, he started going with them for lunches and dinners, and there he started having tea. And it was kind of an immediate love for him that kind of went over to the rest of the family. So whenever I talked to Chris and did tea for him, he kind of inspired me to start teaching him. And I, one night, you know, as you do on a bar napkin or something, wrote down a 10 courses that I could potentially teach of the 10 aspects of tea. So one all about white tea, one all about oolong tea. My favorite is a 2-part series on the 10 famous teas of China and also the health benefits of tea. And I just started doing it for small groups of about 8 people. And we would kind of, I would build them as each new one came. So I had a deadline in front of me to get this done and do the research, but also was really great for me to learn more about tea. So that was done. And then I put all on the website, shreveporttea.org, for anyone to use that resource.
What do you think the greatest misconceptions about tea that exist in this world? Because I think, you know, there's a lot of people in the world who think of tea as Lipton, perhaps, and sweet or unsweetened.
And there's nothing wrong with that kind of explanation, and that's a great introduction to tea, but what I deal with is loose leaf tea. So actual full tea leaves that aren't cut or damaged or done minimal processing to before they reach, you know, your bowl. And that's a traditional Chinese and Indian and Japanese kind of way to do it.
Do you have a geographical preference?
My preference is kind of what's in front of us. I enjoy Pu'er tea, which is from Yunnan province, southern China. And I also really like Taiwanese oolongs. And that's kind of a really two very different ends of the spectrum, but I definitely enjoy both of them.
So how would you suggest we begin this tea education?
How would we begin? Well, what I kind of have is some examples of what's new and what's happening. This is actually kind of a story of globalization and how it's positive in sharing the cultures that, you know, you have. You know, that's why you're sitting across from someone who's not of Asian descent, but also has a great appreciation for kind of the new traditions and cultures and companies that are making it more accessible to people here in the West. So right now we have a pu'er cake, and I can kind of go through.
Spell that. I don't have a clue what that is.
P-U-E-R-H. And it's a really cool traditional old type of tea making where you press into cakes, which make it ideal for transport. So moving it to Tibet, so Tibetan monks can have it for meditation practices along like a horse trail that still exists today. So it's part of this great culture that we get to have a little bit of. But this particular tea called Milk, Cream, and Alcohol by White to Tea, which is an American who now lives in Yunnan province. And he's finding all these old farms and trees and sourcing it and blending it together and packaging it under his own blends for us here in the West to kind of enjoy. And really the world over. So Milk, Cream, and Alcohol is a song from 1979 from Dr. Feelgood. So a band called Dr. Feelgood. And that's just kind of like the tip of the iceberg about how he puts his own kind of spin on tea. But if you have it, it's objectively great tea. And it's from traditional places, is just a person who has a new experience on it. So you can see that this is compressed tea that's kind of put into a disc that's hard to touch. And this isn't a sacred, there's no, you know, flutes playing. You can touch it, you can hang out, you can kind of break it apart into different chunks and put it together. Now with these cakes, you can also take them and store them. This is kind of the fine wine of tea. You take it, you age it. I've had 1980s pu'er teas before. I've had ones that are just really old, but there's always like a good point to have it.
And how would you age something like that? Because we all know about cellaring wines, but how do you properly age something like this?
Well, you just kind of hit on a nose of a large upstanding debate about dry or humid storage for it. And there's kind of two different schools of thought to it. Me personally, I just can't wait. That's why my wine cabinet is bare, because I just kind of go bottle to bottle. And same with tea. I like to try the fresh young pu'er tea that comes out with it. But as the proprietor says, if you find something that you really enjoy, buy two of them. Buy a whole, you know, stack of them and keep them.
So what is that little white container that you've put the tea in?
It's just a vessel for presentation and to kind of measure it. Tea is really subjective when it comes to, people always ask me, is there a certain amount of tea I use? Is there a certain water temperature? All the different variables. And I say just you need to play around with it and kind of find what's right. Use whatever is suggested by the retailer, but you always want to play with those different variables. So what the type of brewing that we're going to do is called gong fu, which means kind of like kung fu, which is the mastery of karate. This is the mastery of tea. So what it basically means is we're going to use a high leaf to water ratio. So that means the steep time, you know, when you put your bag in, they say put in for 4 minutes.
Yes.
We're going to put it in for a couple of seconds, maybe up to around 30 seconds. At the max, but because of the high leaf ratio, we're going to get a lot of the flavor of the tea a lot faster, but we can also brew it up to 12 times or more, depending on the type of tea. With a bag tea, it's really finely cut, and that takes all the flavor out of it immediately. Those are really dry leaves whose cell walls have already been broken, and using a full leaf, you can just keep extracting from those same leaves. So it seems like it's the investment up front to have a really great experience where you're having the same tea over and over again to learn new things about it.
Okay.
Well, ready to get started?
Yeah.
Cracking. This teapot is from my parents when they went on a tea sourcing trip to China to go learn about the different farms and visit all these wonderful peaks that you read about on the back of the packaging. They got to go actually visit those places, and they brought back a Yixing teapot, which is a very porous clay that as you use it, you know, throughout my life, it will keep a patina of the flavor of the tea in there. So I use this one just for pu'er tea, so it has more of the flavor of, you know, other pu'ers that I've had, and it's very slight.
Garrett, it's starting to sound to me like your tea obsession might be genetic.
You know what? It absolutely is. So if you like to try it, and it's going to be a little warm, I'd imagine. But this one kind of has a straw or like a mushroomy flavor. And it grows as you keep drinking it, or you try different ones. Or if we were to age it, new flavors would appear.
I'm definitely getting the mushroom thing.
Yeah.
It's so subtle.
So my favorite part of tea is learning about the history, where they're from, learning about some of the lore or myths, especially when you go into older Chinese teas. And I also really like the chemistry of it, which is kind of the nerdy part. But the reason we're having this type of tea, or from this leaf, which is from one bush called Camellia sinensis, is because it not only has caffeine, but it has a chemical called L-theanine. And caffeine, you know, if you have too much coffee, you feel, you know, your teeth chattering, your eyes rolling around in your head. L-theanine removes that problem from happening. So you can meditate with this tea, you can have it throughout the day, and you won't go crazy. So the L-theanine kind of gives you a frontal lobe activity in your brain, so it keeps a calming effect while the caffeine keeps you awake. So it's used in meditative practice because of that unique characteristic that only this leaf has.
It's very interesting. Now that I came to the end of the cup, I'm almost getting something floral on the back of my palate, too. Mm-hmm.
And if you smell the leaves, you'll probably get more of that, too.
Mmm, it's so subtly beautiful. So what's going to happen next?
To my knowledge, no one does loose... Well, people have... Different shops have loose leaf tea in Louisiana, but no one does tea education as a part of it. Mm-hmm. Or has, like... What I want to have is more of a tea club where I can talk to people... people that grow tea or source tea and have them get some specialty stuff in and talk about it. And people here in the United States go over to China and source their own tea from the farms and bring it over and sell it directly in the United States. I know there's a company in Austin that does that. And this is the kind of small-knit community that I hope will grow in Louisiana and we'll have more options and, you know, education when it comes to something that we purport as being a deep Southern tradition, which is tea.
Fabulous. I'm into it. Yeah, a new deep Southern tradition. Mm-hmm. Something that goes beyond sweet tea.
Sure.
Thank you, Garrett.
Thanks.
Garrett Johnson of Shreveport Tea. When we come right back, we'll meet a father and son master tea tasters team and for the Louisiana tea production plant that they call home. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, and by French Market Coffee. Every premium blend of French Market Coffee contains a richness that can only be called New Orleans bold. Made from the finest beans, slow roasted in small batches, only one coffee captures the bold flavor of our one-of-a-kind city. French Market Coffee. New Orleans bold.
My name is Malcolm Shelders, Director of Commodities, Tea, at Riley Foods Company.
My name is Scott Shelders. I'm a Commodity Specialist at Riley Foods.
Father and son, Malcolm and Scott Shelders, come from a family with a long history in the tea business. Like their forebears, both Malcolm and Scott are tea masters, trained in the art of tea cupping, the process of tasting and evaluating the quality of loose leaf tea. Louisiana Eats traveled to New Orleans East to the Louisiana Tea Facility, where Malcolm and Scott worked together, ensuring the quality and consistency in each Louisiana tea bag. We spoke to them about their lives in the tea business and a family history steeped in tradition.
Where did it all start with your grandfather?
He started in England. Everybody did. I was born in England. And he was sent over, actually, by Thomas Lipton. And he was a senior tea buyer and taster at Lipton in Hoboken. And then my father worked for Lipton in India, and then Tetley in the UK, and back over here in the US, and that's when we came.
Amazing to find this father-son team here. Mm-hmm. So tell us maybe how different or similar your experiences are in acquiring these skills. How do you become a tea master?
Well, it's just repetitive tasting. And you're building a library in your mind of what it's supposed to taste like. And if it doesn't taste like that, there's a problem. So that's what you're doing. You're just learning about each individual tea, right?
But before, you know, way back when, so many tea tastings, kind of very secluded type of, you know, job and specialty type of job. But now there's a lot of certifications out there where anybody becomes a tea taster or coffee taster. And it is just repetitious. And there is some people that just can't taste. You know, there is people like that. But I mean, if you have a palate for it and you want to do it and you're constantly learning and you can actually train your palate.
Tea, okay, when it's manufactured, and it goes through the withering process and the rolling and the that process, and which the rolling, what that does is it breaks the cells in the leaf, the green leaf, and exposes the juices to oxidation. It starts to oxygen, and it starts oxidizing, and that's where it turns a coppery brown color on the belt. Then it goes into the dryers and they fire it to the black. That's where it would be. Green tea goes through a different process. It doesn't go through the oxidation. It's stopped by steaming or pan firing. So the boiling water, when it's manufactured, it takes on like a natural seal, I guess, around the leaf. And it's also going through a tea bag. So boiling water penetrates the tea bag and opens the seal. And then the tea brews. That's why it should be boiling. Takes 3 to 5 minutes to brew because there's different teas in the bag, in the blend, and that'll guarantee that they all brew. So 3 to 5 minutes, that's why we say that.
And consistency.
So if somebody doesn't do that, they're not gonna get what we've designed it for. You wanna brew it for the right amount of time. It's funny because Louisiana, they always say don't overbrew, but with Louisiana, it doesn't seem to bother it. It still stays, you know, stays nice and smooth, good astringency and all that, and very good, because sometimes even at home you do like 5 minutes or 3 hours because like, oh, who forgot the tea, you know. Water plays a tremendous part, and it's also part of any complaints you get. Their water has a lot to do with it, you know, and their way of brewing it has a lot to do with it. So yeah, but we know once it leaves here, it's good. You know, and like when you run into the people that just don't boil that water because it's too quick, or stick it in the microwave, or they're not getting the full flavor of it. All tea comes from the same bush, okay? So when you're talking white tea, green tea, oolong tea, black tea, they all come from that same bush. It's different manufacturing. That's all that is. And orange Pekoe cup black tea, that's a leaf size. And it's funny, you know, so.
Next, we took a tour of the warehouse, where teas from all over the world used to make their special blend are kept.
Okay, this is the tea warehouse. We store about 16,000 bags, and these are components, basically, from different countries, from different origins. And they're shipped in, and I'm gonna show you upstairs how we go through the quality control on that.
Okay.
But, so this would be after certain specifications are met, and you know, with our importers and at origins, and that's what they do. So we have tea from four different origins. Do I say origins?
Yes, or? Tell us. So where is, I see all of these unpronounceable words on the bags of tea.
Right.
So where did these bags travel from?
Okay, well this is green tea. Uh-huh. This is from China. Okay, and over here, you've got African teas, South America. Okay, these weigh about 132 pounds a piece, and so they come in 40-foot containers, 400 of them to a container, about 44,000 pounds.
Wow!
And that's what all this is. So these are all, a lot of container loads.
And a container, a warehouse like this filled with that quantity of tea, how many times does it get refilled a year? How many pounds?
We try to do, and it depends on the origin. Uh-huh. There's some origins, you have to know their background as far as where they're located, like in African countries. They can get monsoons, they get, so the roads wash out. There's problems like that in shipping. So from those areas, you're talking, I mean, what I'll carry is about, say, 3 months' supply, because it takes about 3 months to get it here. And then other ones, I try to carry about 6 weeks. So you're talking, you know, every 6 weeks to every 8 to 12 weeks turnover, just depending on what origin it's from. So, but I try to shoot for 6 weeks on most of them, other than African countries. When I'm contracting for the tea, okay, and I've said what months I want it to be delivered, they send approval samples of the shipment. I approve the shipment, it gets shipped. When it comes here, we'll draw 6 random samples from 6 pallets, and out of the 20. And then we'll do all our specs for that, our evaluations for tasting, dust density, and clarity. They all have to be within a certain specification. And all my suppliers know those specifications. So they're really working on that their end. So it's not like I'm rejecting things all the time. It doesn't work that way.
That was such a fascinating experience, mm-hmm. to get to see the tea bag line,
yeah.
and see the tea going in the bag and the bags being formed and that whole thing. I understand that, particularly in your family, some of the older generations were horrified by the thought of a tea bag.
A hot tea bag is looked down upon, whether they make a teapot for hot tea. Like my uncle, when he came over to visit, he couldn't believe we were using a tea bag. He just couldn't believe it. He was just, you know, he lived in South Africa, actually, and came over for a visit, and he wasn't brought up that way. For iced tea, I think the bag is what you want, because, you know, it works. You know, you have to have it for iced tea.
Yeah.
I was going to say that the rest of the world does not drink iced tea. It's like 80 to 85% of this country drinks iced tea. The rest is hot tea, but nowhere else in the world do they drink iced tea. So they can't be horrified by the tea bag with iced tea, but you know what I'm saying. So no, we're the only country that does.
Well, we have a great fondness for ice, that if mm-hmm. you travel elsewhere in the world, you'll mm-hmm. discover not everybody's as fond of that
right.
cube.
Right, you know, especially England around there, it's freezing cold. How would you drink iced tea?
That was Malcolm and Scott Shalders, third and fourth generation tea masters for the Louisiana Tea Company.
I love coffee, I love tea, I love the Java Jive and it loves me. Coffee and tea and the Java and me, a cup, a cup, a cup, a cup, a cup, a cup.
Boy. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Join us next week when Avenue Pub owner Polly Watts tells the tale of the work outing of a lifetime, an 8-day trip with her staff to Belgium.
You could go to Belgium and have an extraordinary beer-centric trip and really only visit a couple of breweries and still come back with an amazing experience.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, French Market Coffee, and Rouse's Markets. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau, by Dickie Brennan's Bourbon House, from oysters to redfish, serving fresh Gulf seafood on Bourbon Street, also home to the city's largest American whiskey and bourbon collection, and by Toujac's Restaurant, home of America's oldest stand-up bar, now celebrating 160 years on Decatur Street. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Sarah Holtz, and Reggie Morris. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum.
I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.